Board of Frederick County. Ms. Sherrill, be pleased to hear from you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Monisha Chirayal, and I'm here representing Robert Saramith. Your Honors, federal disability statutes prohibit the police from doing precisely what they did here, subjecting a deaf father and his four deaf children to prolonged detention and investigative questioning without the assistance of any aids needed for communication. The relevant facts are not in dispute. Late one winter night in January 2008, the Frederick County deputies arrived at Mr. Saramith's house in response to a call reporting possible child abuse. They were made aware that the entire family was deaf prior to entering the home, and this was confirmed immediately upon their first encounter with Mr. Saramith. They determined early on that in order to ask him and his children the questions they needed to figure out what had happened, they needed an interpreter. They wrote him a note to that effect, but rather than calling a qualified interpreter as the law requires, as DOJ regulations and guidance makes clear, as their own policy calls for, they summoned Officer Ryan, who was a novice of sign language and who was with law enforcement and thus was actually specifically disqualified under the sheriff's policy from serving as an interpreter. That did not get them anywhere, and they had to rely on yet another unqualified interpreter, Mr. Saramith's father, who has a limited ability to lip read and clearly was not impartial under the circumstances.
What's your proposal then? They shouldn't have gone out there?
No, Your Honor.
They had to respond. There were allegations of child abuse.
Yes.
So you would agree that they had to respond. They need to go to the residence and check it out.
Yes, Your Honor.
You say they should have had somebody better qualified with them.
Our position is that when they arrived on the scene, determined that Mr. Saramith and the witnesses were deaf, and
they were deaf before they went, didn't they?
They've
been told that.
Yes, they were. The dispatch advised them that they were deaf, that the family was deaf. Deputy Rohrer could not recall exactly at what point he was told, but yes, there's no dispute at all that they knew they were deaf prior to the start of any questioning or any detention. Now, what they should have done is when they determined that there was a need for a communication to figure out what had happened.
That was before they got there. They knew that, right? Judge King is asking, what should they have done upon arrival? They knew that before they got there. There was a problem with communication.
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor. And certainly they could have taken steps to prepare, pursuant to their policy, calling it.
First and foremost, I would think they had to make sure there weren't any children that were being injured or something. I mean, the children had to be the first consideration. Do you agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor. ADA and Rehabilitation Act require officers to do what is reasonable under the circumstances to accommodate.
Under the circumstances here was to look first and foremost to the welfare of the children.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's right. Absolutely. And again, we have a situation where they were told there were no weapons.
And so what they did with the plaintiff here is they brought him outside the house and handcuffed him.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Your Honor.
And he was kept like that for, 30 or 45 minutes?
Right.
And then they decided that there was no basis for charging him. Correct? And they removed the handcuffs and left.
Your Honor, that was that happened after they tried to call Officer Ryan. She arrived, attempted to interpret, and failed. They tried to gather more information through the father, who has some limited capacity to lip read. Only at that point, about an hour and 15 minutes after the initial arrival, were they able to determine, again, on pretty scant information, that child abuse had not occurred, and that there was no basis to move forward.
What did they do here that creates liability?
Your Honor, what they failed to do was to accommodate Mr. Saramith's, the children's disabilities by either relying on a qualified interpreter and summoning a qualified interpreter to the scene, or at the very least...
The person that came out there was supposed to be an interpreter, but he or she wasn't really qualified.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
What made the officers liable for what they did? The person they didn't get out there wasn't qualified.
Yes.
And they had to check out the children, and they handcuffed him for 30 or 45 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So does that make them liable?
It absolutely does.
What,
under the
what do they do, retreat then and go back to the station house, even though they have allegations of child abuse because they don't have an interpreter?
No, Your Honor. They could have called a qualified interpreter pursuant to their policy through the We Interpret service right away.
They called somebody they thought was qualified. Turned out it wasn't qualified.
And that's not reasonable. Our position is that it's the ADA requires...
I'm having a hard time getting my hands on this, is what they did wrong.
What they did wrong was to call an unqualified interpreter and rely on multiple unqualified people to facilitate communication in this instance when there was no exigency. They had secured the scene, and there was a need for communication given the complexity of the interaction, which they themselves recognized. Under that circumstance, what they were obligated to do was to call a qualified interpreter, or at the very least, facilitate Mr. Saramith's use of notes, perhaps by adjusting his handcuffs. The fact that they did neither of those things means that they did not fulfill their obligation under these statutes to reasonably accommodate, do what was reasonable to facilitate communication and ensure...
What is this from Frederick, from the sheriff's office?
Your
town, wasn't it?
Your Honor, the record, Sheriff Jenkins did say in his deposition that it was in Middletown, and he testified in his deposition that Middletown is not in a remote part of the county.
How far is it from the sheriff's office?
I do not know. The record does not reveal precisely how far it is from the sheriff's office.
The map would show you how far the sheriff's office is. I assume somewhere down around the city of Frederick, and this was in Middletown. I mean, anyway.
Ma'am, counsel, would it be okay if they had, knowing that they didn't have an interpreter there, to just take him to the station for questioning?
With the use of an interpreter at the station?
Yeah.
I think, Your Honor, that that could have been a reasonable accommodation if they could communicate, you know, what they were doing and why they were there through notes, perhaps.
Come with me. I think they would have gotten through that one. Come with me, and we're going down to the station. That would have been okay.
Your Honor, I think under these circumstances, we know that they have the capacity to call an interpreter to come to the scene. So that weighs on unreasonableness.
You're not going to answer my question.
Okay. Your Honor, I do think that could have been a reasonable accommodation. I do think that issue would have required further factual development in the record, and it could not have been resolved on summary judgment with the record we have.
But this, why do you say this wasn't an exigent circumstance?
Your Honor, the sheriffs were told before they got there that there were no weapons, and when they got there, there was no ongoing violence or abuse. Mr. Saramith did not resist arrest. Did not make any threatening motions. And in fact, that's why they all sort of sat around for a solid, 40 minutes or so, even before bringing him in the house. So when they were responding, they were not yet, they did not necessarily have all the information they needed to determine whether there was an exigency. By the, a couple minutes after getting there, it was clear that no exigency existed, and no one has disputed that here. Your Honors, the basis for this...
At what point did they determine that there was no child abuse going on?
When they arrived at the property, the children were upstairs. Deputy Rohr testified, it's uncontested, the lights were off. And there was no ongoing violence. The record shows that Mr. Saramith did not resist and was not engaged in any violent activity or carrying any weapons of any sort.
But the officers have reasonably had to satisfy themselves that the children were all right. And they did that after 30 or 45 minutes, and they decided not to charge your client, and they took his handcuffs off. They didn't take him to the station house. It's hard to see how they did anything really wrong or how your client was hurt.
A few points, Your Honor. To determine, the officers themselves concluded that in order to determine conclusively whether child abuse had occurred, they needed to engage in questioning of the witnesses and of Mr. Saramith. So in order to make that determination, they needed an interpreter. Actually, it was beyond 45 minutes or 30 minutes that
The judge says the 45 minutes in his opinion.
Okay, Your Honor. It was after a period outside, which may have been 30 to 45 minutes, no conclusive evidence that would justify summary judgment for the defendants on that point. And then there was an additional several minutes inside. Now, in terms of the question of injury, Your Honor, this court has said in the Waller case that an individual with a disability states a claim under the ADA and Rehabilitation Act if he suffers greater indignity or injury than someone who is not disabled in the course of an interaction with an officer, let's say.
How do you distinguish this or get around the Rosen case?
Your Honor, there's the factual circumstances of this case are quite different from Rosen. Rosen involved a drunk driving arrest on the side of the road late at night. What needed to be communicated was fairly limited. They just required Rosen to take a breathalyzer test. It was not the complex, prolonged type of interview that was at issue here. Also, the circumstances were more exigent in the sense that Rosen was on the side of the road, potentially creating a danger to others by driving drunk, and the entire issue of whether or not he could continue to drive had to be resolved in a matter of minutes before he got back on the road. This case involved a contained situation in a house. Again, no weapons or arrest. The officers themselves determined that they had the time to sit and wait for an interpreter. They were the ones that initiated this call for an interpreter that turned out to be completely unqualified. So factually, this case is quite distinct. Now, of course, to the extent that this panel believes that Rosen squarely holds that the ADA and Rehabilitation Act cannot apply to involuntary police activities such as or police encounters such as detention and arrest and questioning, then Rosen does need to be overturned in order to address the legal issues.
So Rosen applies, and it says basically your client wouldn't have been entitled to be accommodated until he gets to the station house. I think it's what they call it.
And that was an alternative ground in Rosen. Rosen actually initially said that the ADA and Rehabilitation Act don't apply to arrest or drunk, detention on a drunk driving charge at all, because those are involuntary activities not expressly mentioned in the words of the statute. The Yeski case from the Supreme Court invalidated that reasoning. Now, Rosen had an alternative ground, which was even if the ADA covered this type of involuntary police activity, the obligation to reasonably accommodate would not kick in until you arrived at the station house. I would disagree with that premise, Your Honor.
That's the law of this circuit, isn't it?
No, Your Honor. This circuit recently decided the Waller case, in which the court assumed that the ADA does apply, before a station house, before the officers arrive at a station house.
One panel doesn't have the power to change another one in our system here. Like we don't have we can't change Rosen, and the other panel mm-hmm. that you're talking about couldn't have changed Rosen. If Rosen's applicable, it's the precedent, right?
Well, and again, Rosen is distinguishable on its facts.
So you say it doesn't apply, right? Yeah. That's what you want to say. Rosen is distinguishable on the facts. It doesn't apply. But if it does apply, you said we ought to overrule it.
Your Honor, again, I do understand that one panel cannot overrule another panel, but that aspect of Rosen, that if that is a holding of Rosen, that the ADA does not apply to involuntary police arrests, detentions, then that is no longer valid under Geske. And this court, perhaps sitting en banc, could consider whether it's important to overrule it. Again, it is not necessary to decide the case in our favor because it's factually distinguishable.
Thank you very much. The red light there came on, but you've saved 5 minutes.
Okay, yes, thank you.
Ms. Lee?
May it please the court. Good morning. Sandra Lee, I represent the Board of County Commissioners of Frederick County, Frederick County's Sheriff Charles Jenkins, and the individual Sheriff's Deputy Travis Rohrer in this case. First, I would like to address the exigent situation which did confront the deputies when they appeared at plaintiff's home in the middle of the night in response to a 911 call advising that there was child abuse in progress. The caller advised that she observed the father hitting one child, that she observed the child was injured and had injury to her elbow. There was also a mention that a child had run away from the home. Based on this court's prior ruling in Rosen, defendants respectfully submit that the grant of summary judgment below should be affirmed. Plaintiffs argue that there were no exigent circumstances in this case, as if they were making a plea to the court to make a factual finding of no exigency confronting the deputies. I respectfully submit that as a matter of law, pursuant to the Supreme Court's holding in, I believe it was Michigan v. Summers, there is exigency whenever police officers respond to an individual's home in circumstances such as these in this case. The Supreme Court's statement was that the officers, responding officers, are entitled to detain an individual when the only apparent danger to officers is the danger inherent in the fact of their unwanted presence. These officers arrived in response to your earlier question as to where the home was located. The officers, I don't know where it is, and it may not be in the record before this court in the joint appendix, but the officers testified that it was in Middleton, out in the country. It took them almost 15 minutes to get there, and they were the closest officers to the scene. There is we interpret contract that the sheriff's office has with qualified interpreters. It provides that in a situation such as this, where there is an emergency, the sheriff's office can call We Interpret, and We Interpret will provide a qualified sign language interpreter in a minimum of 1 hour. So as a matter of law, we respectfully submit that there were indeed exigent circumstances. As a matter of fact, based on the testimony of Deputy Rohrer, one of the responding deputies, in his deposition, which is in the record, I believe it's at page 115 of the joint record extract, he said that domestic calls are some of the most dangerous calls that they ever receive. The claim that the officers were entitled to rely on a caller stating that there were no weapons in the home, completely overlooks the unstable, dangerous situation that faces any law enforcement officers who appear at a home where there is an unknown number of individuals. The weapon can be anything like a broken bottle, a kitchen knife, or even a baseball bat. Doesn't mean it has to be a gun. So there were exigent circumstances in this case. The Plaintiffs are asking this court to find, to hold, that the ADA and Rehabilitation Act apply in circumstances that no circuit in this country has held they apply in circumstances where police officers are making a emergency response to a report of a disturbance or incident in progress in the field in a location that's actually more dangerous than on a public street, for example, because it is in a private residence where what is within the home is not immediately known to the officers. In this case, the officers responded. They learned at approximately the time that they arrived, according to the deposition testimony, that the individuals were deaf. Perhaps they should have known while they were en route. They were informed that individuals in the home were deaf. When they arrived, they knocked on the door, did not receive an answer, and were advised to shine lights into the windows in order to alert the individuals in the home of their presence. They did so. There was a response to their approach to the door. And when they encountered Mr. Saramith, the plaintiff who came out, they advised him to step outside while they went inside to investigate further. They had requested from dispatch a description of Mr. Saramith, who was the individual who was reported to be hitting his children. And therefore, when he came to the door, they had reason to believe and believed that he was the individual who was claimed to be abusing the children, hitting his children.
The call log indicates that within 10 minutes of their arrival, they determined that there had been no abuse. So how would events change if a qualified interpreter had showed up?
Frankly, Your Honor, events would have remained, it's our understanding that the events would have transpired very much as they did had a qualified interpreter arrived. And while the court refers to the call log for the determination of no abuse having occurred, in fact, the investigation did require that the officers remain for approximately an hour and 15 minutes after they first arrived, yes, at the residence, before they were satisfied that no abuse had occurred and that the situation was, no abuse had occurred previously and there was no ongoing current need for the officer's intervention. I don't believe that the facts in the evidence support a finding that the officers in fact determined, okay, we're satisfied, no abuse and no assault has occurred. Your Honor, pursuant to this court's holding in Young versus Prince George's County, an officer or officers responding to a scene such as this are entitled to detain the individuals suspected of or accused of committing a crime. Even complete deprivation of a suspect's liberty does not convert the investigatory stop into an arrest. Mr. Saramith was never arrested. The only court in any of the circuits that has held that the ADA applies, and we'll use the same, the Rehabilitation Act's standards mimic those of the ADA's, and so they will be discussed together, with the single exception that the Rehabilitation Act requires that there be an allegation and proof of federal funding for the entity, something which, by the way, is missing in this complaint. The fact that an officer may handcuff and detain an individual pending the investigation, and that this court, the Supreme Court in Moran v. Burdine, has held that under those circumstances, an individual is not entitled to communication. He is not entitled to know why he is being investigated. He is not entitled to have any communication from or to the investigating officers at that time. And in fact, as a previous public defender, I can attest that many, many, many arrested individuals claim, at least, to have no idea why they're arrested until arraignment, when they get an attorney and are or appear before the commissioner in this county, in Maryland. Only Gorman, I believe, the Eighth Circuit case, has held that there was any entitlement to ADA Title II reasonable accommodations during an arrest. And in that case, it was after an individual had been placed into a transport van. He was paraplegic. He was not secured adequately. He fell and hurt himself. And the ruling that the ADA applied in those circumstances was consistent with the holdings in other circuits that have not gone so far as to say the ADA applies in the arrests, that there were no longer exigent circumstances at that time, that the individual with the disabilities had a right to be transported safely. The ADA does not entitle and does not provide for a disabled individual rights that other individuals do not have. It's not an affirmative action policy or procedure whereby you or I, if the police came to our home, would not be entitled to know why they came there. But a disabled individual, in this case a deaf plaintiff, Mr. Saramith, did have a right to know why they were there. The ADA does not require that the officer's entitlement to handcuff the suspect while they secured the premises and made sure that there were no other children involved, that they had indeed spoken with or communicated with all four of the children and made sure that there were no children in danger. The officers were entitled to detain Mr. Saramith, to handcuff him by law, but it's established in the Supreme Court and prior holdings in this circuit. The ADA does not vitiate or reduce the entitlement of responding law enforcement officers to take those measures for their own protection and for the protection of others.
You agree that but for the exigency that those rights would apply on the ADA, but for the exigency?
Pursuant to the holdings in this circuit, Your Honor, no. This court in Rosen has held that the accommodations first, that the arrestee was not in any way denied the benefits of his arrest when he failed to understand as well as another arrestee what the communications were. And in this circuit, it is the law that there is no application of the ADA or Rehabilitation Act prior to an arrestee's arrival at the station house.
Did Waller say that?
Pardon?
Did Waller say that?
Waller did not address. Waller left unanswered the question whether the ADA applied in the arrest proceeding. What it did was it addressed the accommodations that were made. Waller held that it did not go so far as to say that the ADA applies either to the investigation with no arrest or to an arrest. It declined to decide whether the ADA applies and whether the duty of reasonable accommodation applies during the police response to the standoff, which in that case was 2 hours long. It expressly declined, the court in Waller expressly declined to follow the Fifth Circuit in Hines, which reasoned that, Hines v. Richards, which reasoned that the ADA should not apply to an officer's street responses until the crime scene was secure because of exigent circumstances. Instead, the court in Waller looked to the reasonableness of the accommodations that were provided and stated that exigency bears materially on the inquiry into reasonableness under the ADA. It found, the court in Waller found, held that the exigency was not confined to just, you know, an initial encounter, but exigency existed over the entire period. When the situation was unstable, it held that exigency was one of the circumstances that should be considered in whether the accommodations that were made were reasonable. The holding of the court in Waller that was that the plaintiff's proposed accommodations, that an expert mental health person be summoned to provide the best communication possible with the criminal suspect.
That would be unreasonable.
Goes beyond, exactly. Goes beyond what's
meant. Recognize, though, that there are some accommodations may be appropriate, but you have to weigh against, one, the extent of the exigency, and the reasonableness of the accommodation. But Waller did, in terms of trending, that there, in recognition that accommodation may occur. My question is, I'm not asking you to concede any facts in this case, but I'm saying it largely depends on the fact that your exigency existed throughout that 45 minutes to 1 hour. Is that correct?
That is certainly one of the circumstances that was attendant in this
case.
And
you would agree, though, that it certainly is not unreasonable for someone to want an interpreter so they can talk to a police officer who might be charging them, correct? That's different. He's not asking for a psychiatrist to come and do a DSM-3 analysis. He just wanted to be able to say, can you help me communicate with this officer so he won't arrest me? That can't be unreasonable, would it?
No, that amount of accommodation,
right. So
wouldn't they be reasonable?
So under Waller reasoning, it's the exigency that saves you, correct?
The exigency, as Waller held, is certainly a relevant factor.
A factor? What, I mean, that bad thing
is
one
of the circumstances?
It's the whole thing. You talked about Fourth Amendment. You know, police officers normally, right. You come to my house without a warrant and say, I want to talk to you. I can tell the police officer, get off my property. Can I?
Of course.
But if I can't hear, I can't do that. So if there's no exigency and you just routinely, well, deaf people say, oh, no, I'm coming in. He didn't say I couldn't come in because he couldn't hear you. And that may be a circumstance where you weigh no exigency with the accommodation being reasonable. I'm just in terms of where the law is going. I'm just saying in terms of the reach of this case, it's the facts of exigency, right? And
that, yes, Your Honor.
But it certainly can't be that unreasonable. You agree it wouldn't be unreasonable to want an interpreter just to, so, for example, all they wanted was just give me kind of write a note. But he was manacled and couldn't even write a note. That can't be an unreasonable accommodation alone without exigency, would it?
If in the situation where with Your Honor,
yeah, under
proposes,
these facts here, how could it be unreasonable to want to have at least a piece of paper to write down, I did not hit my daughter, blah, 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 blah. How would that be unreasonable?
That would not be unreasonable.
Right. It's the exigency that you rely on.
Of course,
I assume.
Because the officers were entitled to preserve their own safety by keeping the gentleman handcuffed behind his back and keeping him away from the children while they did the initial investigation. Yes, Your Honor.
And likewise, this case was at the man's castle, not on a highway driving a car. That's what the Magna Carta, the greatest restraint of the king is, and he came to the baron's homes and your home, right? That was the whole idea of recognizing that right that we now call the Fourth Amendment right. Right?
Under those rights, Your Honor, people pursuing their rights to be in their homes are pose a greater threat to officers who just appear at the homes than would occur at a public street.
Yeah, I'm surprised you didn't argue, but your exigency is beyond just whether or not they're going to arrest him for the abuse, but it's also to determine whether or not they're going to allow him to stay in the home with his children. Because even if there wasn't abuse, it could be such a rancorous atmosphere. For example, I can't believe you called police on me and said lied like that. If a police officer observed that kind of rancor, they could say, wait a minute, I'm not arresting you for that, but I'm telling you, you're not going to stay with these kids tonight because I consider it to be a threat. So the exigence is also to determine whether or not they should be able to stay together as a family. Is that right?
Well, thank you, Your Honor. Yes, that goes to the issue of whether the situation was resolved within the first 10 minutes when the officers made an initial determination that there did not appear to be ongoing child abuse in progress. To wrap up, Your Honors, the plaintiff has argued that the failure to comply with the internal regulations of the Sheriff's Department show that there was a violation of the ADA. That's just not the case. If the speed limit is 55 miles an hour and I tell my teenage driver to keep it under 50 and she exceeds my internal regulations and goes to 52, that is not relevant to the determination of whether she violated the law. Same with the internal regulations in this case. If the Sheriff's Department has promulgated internal regulations with the hope that their officers will better comply with the ADA, any failure to strictly comply with those internal regulations is not relevant to a determination whether the ADA applied or was violated. In this honorable court in Rosen determined that an individual has suffered no cognizable injury when he has suffered humiliation that is common to that suffered by anybody who's stopped for drunk driving. Mr. Saramith suffered no cognizable injury greater than that of any of us to whom the police responded. Finally, I do procedurally wish to put on the record that the ADA has been held by every court that's considered the issue not to apply to an individual such as Sheriff Jenkins or Deputy Rohrer because the individuals are not public entities. Same with the Rehabilitation Act. The 11th Amendment also grants the state actors, the two sheriffs, the sheriff and the sheriff's deputies, immunity. The county is not liable for the acts of the sheriff's deputies because they are, by Maryland Constitution and Maryland statutory law, state actors and not county actors.
Your red light's on.
Yes, Your Honor, I will, this time will submit. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. Ms. Sherio.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to respond to four specific points raised by counsel. First, as to how long it would take for an interpreter to get there, the interpreting contract does say at page 218 of the joint appendix that interpreters are to arrive immediately in response to call emergency calls for assistance, not more for an hour or less, not at a minimum of 1 hour. As to the question of whether any federal circuit has held that the ADA applies to arrest circumstances, counsel suggested that no court has held as much. That's not correct. Hines v. Richards case is just one example where the Fifth Circuit made crystal clear that once the scene is secure, the ADA absolutely does apply, and the obligation to reasonably accommodate an arrestee would kick in. Third, on the question of exigency, I think it's important to keep in mind that the district court did not decide this case on the question of whether or not there was an exigency at hand. The district court ground for this case was that the ADA and Rehabilitation Act do not apply in the context of a detention or an arrest. It did not dig into the factual issues that bear on whether or not the scene was safe and the officers could reasonably wait for, say, a qualified interpreter to arrive. And in fact, the facts show a dispute on this issue, a genuine material dispute at the very least. Even if we assume that officers can expect a potential emergency situation when they get a call about child abuse and they're responding to the home. You know, when they get there and there's no abuse in progress, there's no resisting arrest, there's really no chaos, then the exigency has subsided, and it's no longer reasonable to say we're just, you know, not going to provide a qualified interpreter or facilitate communication through, say, note writing. Finally, I want to address the issue that was raised about what communication is required, right? We do not contest the holding in Moran that the Fourth Amendment does not require officers to tell an arrestee or detainee exactly, you know, the nature of his arrest. But this case is not about constitutional law. It's about what the ADA and Rehabilitation Act require. And what they require is that government actors ensure that communication with individuals with disabilities is as effective as it is with individuals who do not have disabilities. And this is illustrated specifically, set out expressly in the regulation.
Doesn't that hurt you in this case? What would be the objective of talking to the police officer through the interpreter? What would be the objective?
It's two ways. The police officer has to gather accurate information about what happened.
Your client's way. What would be the objective? Police officers at my home investigating child abuse, what would be the ultimate objective of your communication?
From the client's perspective, his objective is to communicate and respond to the officer's questions about what happened.
The police officer will conclude that what? There's no basis to charge him, so they can be on their way and leave his home, correct?
That may well be his objective.
What other objective would you have?
I think his objective is also to understand what's going on, and yes, to communicate.
Understand what's going on, but wouldn't the objective be you want a police officer to conclude that there's no basis to arrest you and leave?
Sure,
isn't that what happened in 45 minutes?
Your Honors, it is true that the officers ultimately decided not to arrest and charge him, but the Robertson case is very on point here. That fact alone is not enough for the police officers to have satisfied their duty because they did not provide Mr. Saramith with meaningful access to the communication that was going on. That was exactly what was at issue in Robertson, in which a deaf individual was ultimately not charged, but was...
Counsel, you mean to tell me a police officer comes, you're the victim, alleged victim, mm-hmm. I'm the alleged assaulter. You mean you have as the police officer come, they can't say, listen, you to me, you sit down. I don't want to hear from you. I want to talk to her. You have a right to have a police officer?
No.
Hey, anyone, you have a right to the police
officer? Your Honor, the police could well have done that. But in fact, here, what they did instead was say, we want to talk to you. That's why we're going to call an interpreter. And actually proceeded through their unqualified interpreter to effectively interrogate this man in a foreign language. That is not what happens to non-disabled arrestees. You don't have someone coming and speaking to you in Spanish if you don't speak in Spanish and asking a question.
In reality, they speak in a language of expletives sometimes. Shut the up. I don't want to hear from you. And then talk to someone else. People who can hear. That's what happens in reality a lot of times. They tell you, shut up. I don't want to hear from you. I want to hear from her. It happens a lot. Foreign language or not, hearing or not. Police officers do it all the time. They just shut up. I don't want to hear from you. I want to know whether this alleged victim, what happened to her, and is she still frightened of you? And I want to hear from her. I don't want you to intimidate them. I mean, I don't understand. How do you say that there's a right, that there has to be a balance in this investigation at this point, given the exigency of the circumstances?
Your Honor, the fact is, in this case, the officers did not do that. They didn't say, we don't want to hear from you at all. They said, we're going to get an interpreter. They got an unqualified interpreter and tried to ask him questions. And that was their failure because they asked him questions in a language that he could not have ever been expected to understand.
If there was a non-disabled arrestee mm-hmm. there instead of a disabled potential arrestee, mm-hmm. were the injuries any different between the two?
Yes, Your Honor. Again, the language set forth in Waller is that the disabled individual suffers greater indignity or injury than a non-disabled individual. Mr. Saramith was interrogated in a foreign language, did not understand what was going on, could not communicate and respond to questions that were being asked of him. And that caused him humiliation and anger that persists after the incident. And he did see a counselor, and it was not just because he was arrested, but rather because in the course of the detention, he was communicated. He was not provided with any opportunity to communicate. He was effectively gagged. Moreover, the entire process took over an hour and 15 minutes when, as had been the case in other instances, it could have been resolved in a matter of minutes. Your Honors, I would encourage the panel to please reverse the decision below granting summary judgment to defendants and remand for entry of partial summary judgment for plaintiffs on the issue of the applicability of the ADA and Rehabilitation Act to arrests, and a finding that there was a failure to reasonably accommodate by either providing a qualified interpreter or allowing Mr. Saramith to write notes. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. We'll come down and greet counsel and take a short break.